Hello, and welcome to Art Table's podcast series, Artist Perspectives. I'm Jessica Porter, Art Table's Executive Director, and I'm looking forward to sharing this series with you. Since 1980, Art Table is the leading professional organization devoted to supporting women in the visual arts. Art Table's Artist Perspectives podcast puts Art Table members in conversation with women artists at the forefront of their practice.
Jean Shin is an artist nationally recognized for her monumental installations that transform everyday objects into elegant expressions of identity and community. Shin's site-specific work fills a gap, her process consisting of a thoughtful analysis of the community in which the artwork is to be situated. In this recording, you'll hear about Shin's often funny or unpredictable stories of collaboration, which lead to meaningful works with monumental impact. Shin's work has been exhibited in over 150 major museums and cultural institutions, including solo exhibitions and a landmark commission for the MTA's Second Avenue subway at the 63rd Street Station in New York City. Jean is also a friend of Art Table, and this year we were lucky to collaborate with her for our annual benefit. Here's Shin speaking at our artist breakfast meeting alongside the work included in the 8th Floor's exhibition, Sedimentations, Assemblage as Social Repair.
Thank you, ladies. This morning, it's such a privilege to be in this room having breakfast. Very early. This is probably the earliest lecture artist talk I've done, so bear with me. And I can tell the ambition in this room and the many lives we've all lived. And it's a shout out to one of my first gallery owners, Frijuka Taylor, who is a longtime Art Table member and loved this community. And she has invited me many times in my early career. And one of those pioneers that I miss her dearly. And I know that this platform is one of those things where relationships count. And that's kind of where I wanted to kind of mention her. But there's so many people in this room. Janice, the first person who hired me for my full-time job at MoMA, and Lisa, and Sarah. You know, there's so many people in this room. So again, we have so many lives, and it's wonderful to be able to share what was happening, which is the evolution of my work. And these are sandbags that I collected from the Wave Hill community. Originally, it was a proposal for a response to Hurricane Sandy. And in my studio that's based in Red Hook, I was completely devastated by the water coming through the studio. And years later, I still think about what have we learned from that experience of vulnerability? And really, like, what's the human toll, right? Not the how much numbers of damages in real estate are we talking about, but really the human toll that often don't get measured. And these studios, the businesses all over the waterfront, but you know, the project spaces, and I was thinking about the people trapped up in, you know, the 20th floor, that sort of thing. So gathering these jeans and filling it with sand as the sandbags, a levy, a proposal for a levy, that we really do need to protect our community, our city, our livelihood, our spaces, our neighborhoods. And that really still hasn't happened, right? And there's really no plan in place. And I also think personally, my studio's still there, and where are my sandbags? What if there's another storm? And the reality is the sandbags aren't available when you need them, right? If you stored up the sandbags, they're just deteriorated by the time the storm comes. When the sandbags do get delivered, and if you get to get them, they're 60 pounds. They're too heavy to move, you know? So this is an idea of a sort of scaled-down version, something that you can move yourself. It's related to your human body. So everything from, you know, large man's jeans to a little kids' denim is included in this piece. It goes back to one of my very first installations that Joy showed. And it's called Alterations. And I was originally studying painting, and to get off the floor came through material. This was pant cuffs. They're altered handcuffs, and I'm not standing today, which is so nice, but you will tell I'm very, very petite in my height, as most Asian people are. We don't fit the normal Western, you know, standards of fashion, and so there's always this kind of couple inches for me. It's like literally an inch and a half that I do not wear, and so you always have to deal with it, whether it's altering them or, you know, rolling them up or whatever you need to do. But it's always trying on something and knowing that you don't fit. And that seems to be kind of a message that you get all over when you exist in this society, is that you don't fit. And in fact, I really wanted to say, well, no, what if there's a world in which all of that exists and everyone else disappears? You know, that person who never had the clothes and they fit that ready-to-made for them, the average, is not actually our body. So these are all altered cuffs that I gathered from laundromats and alteration shops. And they were the sizes I didn't, the cuts I did not touch. I just stiffened the fabric so that they can stand on their own. So it's sort of sending a presence, but really, really an absence. They never existed, really. Because this is the unwanted leftover hem. In this relationship, it got me to move outside my studio practice. As a painter, I was devoted to being in the studio. Here, I was collecting my materials, so I was visiting my neighborhood alteration shops. And I'm doing that, asking them, can I, you know, barter or something? Would you mind holding these? And they were like, I throw this stuff out all the time. You want it? That's great. You know, so they would start to collect them for me. And I realized the relationships I was building was with a Korean-American alteration shop at every corner of New Yorker. Said, I know a Korean person. Oh, they're so wonderful, family around the corner, the deli, the laundromat. And so I realized that suddenly I was sort of tapping into my own social network to make art. So this move from non-traditional materials is something that I had really enjoyed doing because it sent me to an adventure I couldn't imagine. Connecting and speaking Korean to get my art materials, to call them my auntie. Oh, auntie, how are you? And, you know, just being really affectionate with people who were total strangers to me. But then they were so open to helping me. Then I started to think about the landscape, something that I would be inspired by doing my walks to the studio. And after a storm, there was this devastating storm that just all the umbrellas were spewed through New York City. And again, every corner is piled up until the sanitation workers come and clean them. And they go pretty fast because they're really good. But sometimes in heavy corners in downtown, they do pile up. And places that don't get the service pile up forever. And I rescued these umbrellas. Literally, my friends would tell me, you should go on the corner of such and such. And I would find that what time the sanitation workers would come and clean up so I could be there before. And rescue these umbrellas. And to me, they were sort of like the wings of a bird or something, that they're usually with us, intimate in our bags, carried with us. But the minute they break, and it's usually like one little mechanism, one joint, we throw the whole thing out. And I felt like this notion of obsolescence, that they were designed for us to just throw out the moment that that one point disappoints us. So I really repaired them, or re-sewed them, allowed airflow to go through them and to represent them at Socrates Sculpture Park as well, one of my first solo shows, to kind of say they have a new life. You know, they didn't disappoint us. We failed them. In fact, to reintroduce them in the sunlight and the wind, this piece, again, working in the public space, working at that scale, I'd never seen this piece in my studio. I just kept sewing. And I had dimensions of how many trees, and it was like 74 feet or something. And I was like, I'm just going to keep sewing. And then, you know, my studio wasn't that big. I'd never see it. And then when we got up there, the work surprised me. It pulled itself through the trees and became part, integrated with the sculpture park. And when it did that, it perfectly synced up and then moves with the trees. And so in some way, it was taking a breath. It was literally coming to life, and it would just take this inhale, and then slowly you'd have to wait for it to take an exhale. And I just thought that was so beautiful. And in these gestures where the work was teaching me what it wanted to do, and then I'm always looking for that surprise. Like I said, I'm going to show up umbrellas, I'm going to rescue these things and give you a canopy, and it's going to create shadow. And you're going to need shadow because you don't have enough of it. You don't have enough trees in this landfill, right? This term sculpture park. So that was my gesture. But then I realized, oh, my God, it's taking a breath. It's the wind that I'm capturing. Not so. It's always something else in the public works. Doing these public works, of course, became my go-to. I always wanted to do something that created the unexpected. And so something that was slightly, you know, my idea, but also in participation with something, collaboration with something. So whether it's with nature, the unexpected wind, and sometimes a storm. But here I thought the museum. And the museum is a place, of course, having worked at MoMA and at the Whitney, being behind the scenes, being a cultural worker, you know, in many different departments, you know, I realized that we're like the invisible, you know, the art and the artists, of course. Not many of us are women who are shown in those major institutions. They're the men. And the women are the workers hidden behind the scene, you know. And so I wanted, when MoMA had asked me to do the show, and it was the first museum exhibition, they said, you do large-scale works. We'd love to do a site-specific project with you. I was completely floored. I'm thinking, what do I want to do? And I didn't want to just rescue something, and I didn't want to just look at discards. I really wanted to speak to the site. And so it became the shift in making a site-specific work that engaged that community. And I felt like I knew this community inside out. I know the work, the many lives, and yet how do I make that visible to the public? So the curator and I thought, you would be my ambassador. You would go and tell all the staff that I'm doing this project where I'm trying to map that community. So everyone would donate a work clothes. So it was kind of the dress code, the professional lives that we have, and what do you wear to work to fit in, you know, or to stand out or to be distinctive. So these notions of community and identity and the individual kind of mapped within the larger collective. So this is MoMA. So you could be whoever you wanted, but you're still going to be on the MoMA umbrella. And of course, you know, the MoMA umbrella is complex like any other network. There's hierarchy, there's departments that don't get along, there's individuals that don't get along, there's individuals who love to collaborate, there's individuals who don't, you know. So collecting this clothes, she got to kind of get to know people and to reach out to people like, where is your office? Where's your department, in fact? You're the first one person I've ever met in this department. We don't work closely enough. And others where she sees them every day, you know. So it's such a big network of people. It was amazing to kind of get into the institution and, of course, create a group portrait that kind of doesn't exist. They could never be in the same space, in the same room, hundreds of people. They work many different shifts, you know. And also the fact that this was happening at MoMA Q&S. So this was a time of displacement and fragmentation, and people were being scattered or let go and furloughed. And I just thought, like, oh, my God, this is destroying the community. So this fragmentation is all about how we are individuals that get sort of relocated in place. And then we sort of also come together. So there's a bit of reality check, but also an idealism about creating this group portrait. That project led me to an invitation to do my first public work that was permanent. And I just looked at them like, who are you talking to? Like, not me. I do these ephemeral things out of like discarded things. And so it was completely amazing that the federal government asked me, but you do large-scale works, yes? We're not a pilot emerging program, Jean. I'm like, I get that, so I'm confused why you're choosing me and asking me to do a proposal. Anyway, it was a really amazing growing time for me to imagine making my works more permanently. So I worked with a conservator and have continued to love working with conservator. This was a fabric conservator. So the federal building there was a site for immigration and naturalization, which to me, that's how I came to this country, my family's history. And in fact, we came to the same exact building in Baltimore. So it was like I was coming home and I didn't know this. And then the other group was the veterans were another big, big headquarter in this building and a community I don't know, but I just done a project called Armed. Some of you have seen that at the Philadelphia Museum. And I collected veterans' uniforms. So after I did MoMA, I was thinking like, well, that was an easy community. I know these people, like curators and registrars and librarians. These are people I know. But I don't know anyone in the military. I don't know what it means to wear this uniform and go out in the world and serve like their mission. You know, I'll die for art, but I don't know how to die for that, you know. So I imagine, like, that would be a really crazy community to know. So I had done this project getting military clothes. So when I saw that there were the veterans administration headquarters, I was like, I know this community as well. I don't know them intimately. I know them through the stories and the people I met. So I asked them to donate clothes. The Veterans Administration, of course, could send out a reach out. They're part and networked and helping their veterans. So that was easy. And I already had those conversations with so many veterans. I knew the dialogue. And there were willingness to sacrifice and give me their one uniform that they held on to. So this was where it wasn't discarded. It was I held on to this. This defines me. This is who I am, and I'm unwilling to let go because how can I just throw this away? And yet, when an invitation, like an artist wants those uniforms to be part of this larger conversation, that's when they're like, now I'm an excuse to let this go. You know, and before I'm done, no one's going to want this uniform, and I can't put it on or anything. It's something that I did when I was 18 in my 20s. And so they were so willing to give this up because it represented something that they felt they wanted to be part of, which is the same reason they joined the military in the first place. So these the naturalization and citizenship process was more difficult because they said, we're not in contact with these people. They get their paperwork sometime. They sometimes visit. Sometimes they don't. And they show up for the one day of citizenship. So they said, we're happy for you to come that day. And I was like, really? This is such an important day. The most important day of their life. And then I'm going to say, hey, would you participate in an art project? But that is exactly what I did. I know this is very exciting. Before we begin, we have artist Jean Shin asking for a request. So I showed up and said, hi, welcome. And of course, when I looked in the sea of people, my heart went right back to my parents and their struggle and that nervous day, like, my God, we worked so hard to get here and now we're going to be U.S. citizens. What does this mean for us and my family? And it meant that one day you can have an artist who goes, hey, I'm doing a public art project. And the federal government, the U.S., you know, has asked me to do that. And I'm a daughter of an immigrant. I walked through this hallway wondering what my life was going to be and my parents having made those sacrifices in the journey. So I said, so what I'm asking is to give me one of your shirts, your pants, whatever item of clothing that maps you. And they got it. You know, they got that we're here. And why don't we mark this celebration by the common things that we have with us? And some of them only brought a few things. Some of them brought nothing with them. Others were, you know, moving their shiploads of furniture. But most people, it was very selective what you brought to a country, what you wanted to hold on to. And so this man was so great because he said, I want to participate, but when I walk out that door, my life is going to begin, but busy, 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 I'm not going to remember to mail you the shirt. So he took off his shirt and just gave it to me, held out the form and said, it's yours. And I said, one day your children will come back and see your shirt up there. And he goes, yes. And I'm so happy, and I'm sure he is, that he wore undershirt that day. And of course, the veterans also would send me their pictures when they would give me their uniform because they're so proud and this is their memory. I was wearing that when I served. They served in many places, including Korea. So it was really, really interesting to imagine the veterans' experience of Korea versus the local experience of the Korean War. And then this was a citizen from Peru who had gotten. And of course, you know, we got our citizenship in 78. So I was imagining this crew of Asians, like we were just allowed to come into this country. So if you had an invitation, you waited and you got there. And then I look around and it's like Africans and Latins. And it was very different mix of community in the same place in Baltimore. So I realized the new immigration, you know, the passages is, of course, so relevant today. Who do we allow in and who do we not want in anymore? Apparently the Finns are welcomed here. So anyway, you know, this notion of like what's inclusive, who do we welcome as part of our community? Who do you self-identify as part of us? And who do you say you're not ever going to be part of us? And we're never going to tell you that. Or sometimes we'll tell you that right up front. So I started to talk about my own networks. This is a project I did with the Asia Society. And I just thought it was really funny, like, wait, there's an Asia Society and museum. What does that mean, an Asia Society? So I started to look at, like, not their own history, but, like, what does it mean to me to be part of this Asian American arts community? So the curators were Asian American and were mapping that contemporary space. And so I said, well, who are you doing studio visits with? Do I know them? And who are they? Like, who's the organizers of, like, the Korean... Asian American arts community. So I asked them to donate a sweater for me. So the three Asian American curators, Melissa Chu being one of them, and then they would send out their network like a chain mail saying, Jean Shen wants your sweaters. So if I'm sending you this email, I think you're part of our arts community and being Asian American. So please participate. So they give me their sweater and I would unravel it. So I know some of you knit. I do the opposite. I don't know how to knit. I just unravel sweaters. And then I mapped them. I literally put their name on their sweater, even though their thread, their yarn would be loose. And I made a spool of yarn for them. When they participated in New York, I would then send out the email saying, this is all the participants. It started with 60 people. And say, who do you know on this list? This is pre-Facebook. You don't know who you're friends with, and then you don't know who's talking to who and when. You don't see the comments. So it was really an exercise of, I want to know, who do they know? And of course, everyone knows like Lisa Gold, and everyone knows like Lily Wei, and everyone knows Melissa Chu. And you know, it's like, if you don't know those three, you know, you're kind of off on the side. And that's what it was. Like that network was very fragile. And other times it was so robust, you couldn't even get to those people because there's 50 people string attached to them. And they were going everywhere. So Melissa's sweater has like been reduced down almost to her name because her sweater has to go everywhere. And I find that to be a mathematical kind of realization with this project, because it's sort of like, you know, at the end of the day, when you have so many people that you know and demand things of you and you want to help and you want to socialize with, that you feel like, ooh, I just want to go home and do nothing and just be by myself sometimes because there's so little of you that's been shared. And I feel like that was kind of something I wanted to talk about. This project was inspired by literature, so Calvino's Invisible Cities. When I read this book, it was just so striking. But this one city where they're nomadic, and they put their relationships and map them and signify them with the string that is tied. So I need a lecture. You give me your string. I give you the lecture. Oh, I need something else. Then we do a relationship. We do these kind of ties because of need, right, and want. And then over time, there's so many complex relationships that we're like in a room full of knotted string and we can't exist. So then they have to move along and abandon the city. And I also, this is a show that kept moving, so I thought it was interesting to have to relive that network each time. And it's not permanent, as none of our networks are. Some of us are with us at some time really close and others move away. And it's further, it's more complicated to be connected. So each time the work is shown, it gets reestablished, and the city that it moves to gets invited to that network. So in Philadelphia, that's how I met the curator, Hansu Wu. She had participated in my project. I had never met her, but everyone, when I arrived in Philadelphia, was like, you know Hansu. Of course you know Hansu. I said, I know the name. She's participated in my projects, but I don't know her. And this is also questioning how you know someone. Right? Today, everyone says, I'm a Facebook friend. I'm like, I don't know what that means. I know you can get my posts, but you're not the person that I'm going to run into in a conversation and spend an hour, do a date trip or a visit, you know? But that's really interesting. You know, how do we know them? I actually know everything about the vacation you took, but I haven't seen you, you know? So I think about how it's changed how we have relationships and how much information we have with each other when we haven't been in the same space either. So it's become very, very complicated, but this kind of invisible network of people. And I think art tables, like, we should do an art table unraveling project. like invisible networks, you know? Those are the fabric works the textile based works. And it's been a real big thread in my work. And the show, the solo show at the Philadelphia Museum was that, because the Pearlman and that gallery specific shows fashion. So the fashion curator usually has fashion exhibitions of textile. So when Hansu, who had the curator of Korean art, had said, you're not using that space as actively as the contemporary space. I don't have a contemporary space. So why don't we talk? And she was really blown over by the kind of curation of textile-based work. So that's how that show came. And it's always been a thread because I love mapping the body. And the body has always been, as a figurative artist who studied painting and figure drawing, that has been my go-to. So textiles was sort of my primary materials. But the whole looking at fashion industry. Wanted to show again the amazing people behind the scene. These are interns. They had a summer intern of 10 people. They were all making the alphabet, setting the transcription of our emails, you know, and it's so labor intensive. So it's clearly something that I could do, but why would I spend 5 years of my life doing? The fabric workshop just took it over. The project manager managed to create this incredible piece. So obsolescence of materials technology, when we talk about fashion, the quick fashion, you wear it one season, you throw it out. Well, that happens with technology all the time. You know, you upgrade before the thing warrants any repair because it's out, you know, and you toss it away. And that thing that you toss, where does it go, right? So the vast amount of technology. And in music technology, this is a project that I did with the Brooklyn Academy, Brooklyn Music Academy? Band.
Music
Academy, yeah. Band. Academy of Music. Mm-hmm. So they have a Next Wave Festival. And I also thought about that position of like, oh, that's so interesting how performance is so different from a visual arts. And so I wanted to map this wave of performance that happens every year. But then when I thought about it, that's our music technology. Like some of us grew up in the records period. Some of us grew up in the CD period. Some of us grew up in the tape period. Some of us grew up in the MP period. My son has no idea what this is. You know, he's like, there's music? How do you get music out of that? You know, so, you know, it maps a generation and then it's obsolete, you know, and there's some revivals of it, but it's still, it's like the music is there and not there. Like it's accessible, right? So I melted them to thinking about this kind of tsunami-esque moment to be seized when you're just like, this is it, this is it. And then, of course, so 10 years later, it's not it at all. it's surpassed. Other things, I mean, I feel so grateful to have had these collaborations and people kind of also asking me, are you interested in this material? So at the Materials for Arts Residency, they get donations from the Museum on Art, Guggenheim, the Met, you know, all the museum detritus comes to them. Frames, pedestals, you name it, they get it. So the Metropolitan Museum, of course, donates regularly. And then they said, we're going to get rid of our entire slide collection. And they would donate to Materials of Arts. But then Met Media Lab said, wait, hold on. When it gets distributed, it just goes, you know, one by one, the whole thing. You don't really know. So instead they said, why don't we curate some artists, invite them to work with this material? So since I was in residence, they said, oh, we know an artist. Let me ask Jean. So I was so perplexed. Being at the library, you know, thinking about technologies that move, books that no longer get read, slides that are no longer needed. I felt like I lived through the slide generation. You know, I'm so happy now that you can just plug in digital files and you can apply. But back in the day, I had like four sets of my 20 slides, the sheets of slides, and be like, if I give you this joy and you look at it, would you promise to return it to me in my little self-addressed envelope so I can get it back and send it to the next curator? You know, it was this precious commodity that is the only way someone knew your portfolio. No one had websites. There's barely an email. You don't send anything unless you have this. I mean, it was complicated. But there was also something beautiful about slides, you know, and how it maps and contextualizes the work. And at the Met, this was their entire exhibition history. This was their in-house photography, the conservation labs, the library, wow, what happens at the gala, the big, beautiful lobby flowers, you know, when they're bringing in the artwork, when they're doing construction. It's the history that's not going to get published, right? It's the exhibition history that, again, has to be prioritized. And who gets left out? Who gets always back in the iconic works in their permanent collection? that they can re-photograph in any new medium, three-dimensional. They can computer scan this and rebuild it and create replicas. But that exhibition history, like my show, if you saw it, you saw it. If you didn't, no one will know ever. And if it was slide documented, it's gone. This is a project I was hearing from someone who takes the 63rd Street subway. And so I was so privileged to work on the 2nd Avenue subway station when it opened. And this was the first station, so it's a small station because it existed since the 80 years plus. The tunnel was still open. They just didn't have the funds to do it. So we wanted to talk about that construction. And this is the elevated trains that they got rid of in the 40s and 50s. So if the city was getting rid of something, I would have been like, I'll take that. But they didn't have that. They, I wasn't even around. So I sort of talked about that historic memory of losing the elevated train and making way for the 2nd Avenue subway. So these are the people that I found in the archive. So I went to look at the Transit Museum archive and found these beautiful people, New Yorkers, commuting. And I was just looking at the elevated track on the street level, which I cut away and gave the sky. Because a lot of people had said, now that the elevated gone, I don't have this big shadow. I have the New York sky. And I felt like as we're going underground, we no longer ride the elevated, so I wanted to bring back the sky to New York in the space of what was missing, what was gone 50 years ago. But then all these amazing people in their fashion, New Yorkers just commuting, doing their thing, they never got to see the 2nd Avenue subway. These ladies who commuted, a lot of people say from Queens downtown to their office job being secretaries, I was thinking Mad Men the whole time, reading their newspapers and their books. They never got to see the 2nd Avenue subway. Yeah. So I put them back. Uh-huh. And now everyone who rides the 2nd Avenue subway gets to look at these ladies commuting. And then, of course, the view of the city is what we don't get to see as well in the tracks underground. So I get to give back. And so it's a little bit about what we gained and what we lost in that history and remembering what existed before us as we're quickly moving through that fabulous Q train.
This series is supported by the Paulett Krasner Foundation, established in 1985 for the sole purpose of providing financial assistance to individual visual artists. Each artist in this series has benefited from the generosity of the Paulett Krasner Foundation through their grant program. The Artist Perspectives podcast series is just one way that Art Table works to support all women in the arts. To find out more about our initiatives for the advancement of women's leadership, please visit us at arttable.org.